Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Many Americans make a New Year's vow to be more physically active, and then the zeal to exercise fades after a few weeks. But our guest today offers a compelling reason to renew that resolution, because the science shows going for that walk or heading to the gym can extend your lifespan and how well you age. We're talking with science writer Judy Foreman about her new book, Exercise is Medicine: How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. She compiles the latest research on this, from cutting-edge molecular biology to basic recommendations about how much exercise you might need and what kind might be best. Exercise and aging is our topic today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Judy Foreman joins us from WGBH in Boston. Judy, welcome to The Exchange. Great to have you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So everybody knows, Judy, exercise is good for you. Everybody listening is probably going, yes, yes, I know. What new information does your book add?
Well, it adds a lot of science to what's actually happening deep inside our cells and in our genes when we exercise. And I've been a fanatic exerciser, I have to say, my whole life, as well as a science writer. And these two things kind of collided and came together for this book. And I learned so much that I did not know before about exactly what was happening and why exercise is so essential. It's built into our genes, basically, that we should not sit around and we should really move around and exercise.
So you said, Judy, that the need to exercise is inside our cells and our genes. Wow. Tell us more about that.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, this book has a lot of evolutionary biology in it, which has always fascinated me. And we are built to run. There's a wonderful book by the Harvard scientist Daniel Lieberman, who makes a great case for we are, and he's not the only one making this case, by the way, we are genetically programmed to move. What happens inside our cells and what genes get turned on and off when we exercise is incredibly powerful. And it really does make all our molecular machinery hum along, right? We were not built to sit around in front of screens and TVs and computers and pushing papers on desks. We are built to move and even to run. And so sitting, which we think of as normal, is really the anomaly in terms of evolutionary biology.
Wow. You say in the book that exercise improves the, quote, chemical crosstalk among our organs, getting fat, muscles, the brain, just basically everybody housed inside us, talking
That's
to each
right.
other biochemically. That's really
That's
interesting.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, people don't usually think of this, but our cells, you know, quote unquote, talk to each other. They secrete chemicals and the receptors are on the receiving cells. And when that chemical lands on the new cell, it triggers a whole bunch of things inside the cells. This is going on all the time. And exercise helps make this a smoother process so the signals don't land in the wrong place or land no place. All that basic cellular communication is enhanced by exercise, along with a lot of other things that go on, which we can go into if you want.
Oh, absolutely. So it's kind of like a cellular conversation,
That's
you know,
great, yes.
Right? They're all talking
yeah.
to each other. And so the conversation goes smoothly. You need to exercise to make sure all the I don't even know what to say, you know, that all the little parts are talking to each other the right way.
Yeah, the little neurotransmitters, the hormones, the chemicals that cells put out. Yes, absolutely. That's right.
So
that's
if right. you're sedentary, Judy, mm-hmm. what are you setting yourself up for?
Oh, an early, miserable, slothful, disease-ridden life, to put it bluntly. I have a whole chapter called Sitting Kills. And before I wrote this book, I thought that kind of a sedentary lifestyle was just the low end of the activity scale. And I was kind of stunned to discover that sedentary lifestyle is actually a whole separate category of badness. A lot of biochemically destructive things happen when you sit too much. And of course, here you and I are sitting, talking to each other. But sitting has a lot of bad sequelae, if you will. Among the most important is something we all kind of intuitively know, which is that we build up fat. And it used to be thought that fat was just kind of an inert blob of white, kind of yucky tissue. But in recent years, scientists have found out that fat tissue is actually a very active metabolic endocrine organ. And what fat cells put out are these chemicals called pro-inflammatory cytokines. That's kind of a mouthful. But these are chemicals that contribute to body-wide chronic inflammation. Inflammation is a good thing, you know, if you have a cut and your finger swells and stuff, but that goes away. And what chronic inflammation does, it doesn't go away. And inflammation, chronic inflammation, is the underlying cause of a lot of the diseases that plague us as we get older, including diabetes and atherosclerosis and neurodegenerative problems. Inflammation, when it's chronic and all over the body, is really a bad thing. And sitting makes that happen much more than standing and running around.
That's really interesting. And there's been so much put out there recently about inflammation and ways to reduce inflammation in the body and its connection to all sorts of maladies, large and small. But are you saying, and Judy, please correct me if I'm wrong, that fat itself doesn't just sit there? It acts as sort of an entity of its own, creating all these problems with our processes in the body?
That's exactly right. You got that exactly right. Yeah, fat tissue is, you know, we sort of think of it as a vanity kind of thing or sort of vaguely as a health thing, which it is. But it actually is, it's its chemical effect that's really bad. It puts out these pro-inflammatory cytokines. And that's those are really nasty. We don't want those. Interestingly, I have a whole chapter on sitting and what happens when you sit too much. But I also have a whole chapter on the immune system and exercise. And one of the main things that exercise does in terms of the immune system is control this chronic inflammation, because inflammation is part of the immune system. And exercise really dramatically helps control that chronic inflammation.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us today in the exchange. We're talking with longtime science writer Judy Foreman. Her new book is called Exercise is Medicine: How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. We'd love to hear from you, your questions or comments. We all know that exercise is good for us, but Judy's work shows the science behind why it's good for us. And in a few minutes, we'll dig into really how it slows down the aging process, as she says in the subtitle of her book. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook. You can tweet us. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Judy, what is the one sort of overarching reason exercise helps us age better? Let's tackle that part.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of data showing that exercise, and we can get to how much and how often in a minute, but that exercise really does add years to your life, and even more important, it adds health to your life. Right now, I have a great chart or graphic in the talk that I give for this book, and what exercise does is help what demographers call square the curve. Right now, if you can imagine a graph with, you know, when you're born on the left and when you die on the right. And normally there's sort of you start out high in health and gradually go down sort of in a nice little curve and then you die. But that long, slow decline is what happens to many of us as we get older. And that's sort of full of disabilities and disease and other, you know, sort of misery things in later life. What the goal of demographers and, of course, health experts is to square the curve, keep that nice line, healthy line high, and then have it drop off right before you die. So you have really, they call it compression of morbidity, which means kind of clumping up all the bad stuff into a very short period of time right at the end of life. So you don't have this long, slow, unhealthy decline. And that's essentially what exercise can help make happen.
How does it do it? Because aging is a biological process, you know.
Yes, and actually, my whole first chapter is on the biology of aging, which was fascinating to me, among other reasons, being that it isn't necessarily inevitable. Not all creatures on this earth age. Some of them, aging essentially is a deterioration of basically every bodily function, which is kind of depressing. But some creatures, that doesn't happen to. They live and then they die without a lot of ill health in between.
Really? Like what?
Yeah. Oh, sea urchins, hydra, sort of primitive little creatures. But a number of evolutionary biologists say that aging is actually an accidental byproduct of living past our biological warranty period. It isn't necessarily built into our genes that we age. It sort of happens accidentally, but we're not programmed to get old and maybe programmed to die at some point, but we're not necessarily programmed to have all this deterioration that we know.
That's interesting.
Fact,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there was a wonderful study by European researchers, I think it was 2013, and they identified 9 basic hallmarks of aging. And this, to my knowledge, is the first time that anyone really nailed this stuff down at a very basic biological level. And the good news with this is that exercise can help slow down all of these basic 9 processes. And lack of exercise, sitting around and eating too much, speeds them all up. So our Western lifestyle is really the culprit in a lot of these things. And if you want, I can tell you what these 9 are.
Yeah, I'm interested,
but we don't
actually.
Have to.
Yeah, or at least the most important ones or the most recognizable ones.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So I won't say all 9 of them. But one of them is genomic instability, and we can go into them in a minute. One of them is telomere attrition, which is fascinating. So is epigenetic alterations, changes in our epigenetic clock. That's probably one of the most interesting. And another really important one is what happens to the mitochondria, those little energy organelles inside our cells. Mitochondria tend to fall apart as we get older, but exercise definitely revs up our mitochondria. So whatever you'd like to talk about, these things were fascinating and just so encouraging to me as a motivator, because if I don't feel like exercising, I'm like, oh, well, you know, I can really increase my mitochondria if I jump in the pool.
Well, and I've heard of all of these things, all of these biological processes of aging, like right down to the cellular level, Judy. Let's tackle epigenetics, though, because I think a lot of people have probably heard of that. So what is or are epigenetics?
So epigenetics are things that change which genes are turned on, which genes are active, and which ones are not. That's different from mutations, which are changes in the basic DNA itself. So these are things that influence genes, not changing the structure of the gene itself. And there's a major process that occurs in this so-called epigenetic clock. And that's called, and we won't get too bogged down here, but it's called DNA methylation. A methyl group is basically just a little cluster of carbons. And as we get older, these methyl groups latch on to different parts of the DNA, telling different genes to turn on and turn off. And as we get older, the DNA methylation goes on at an increasing rate, so there's more of it. In fact, when they look at centenarians, people who are over 100 years old, their DNA methylation pattern is strikingly young. It looks like that of a younger, much younger person. So the DNA methylation is a good way to sort of gauge biologically how old someone is. That's part of the epigenetic clock. And the cool thing, I mean, if listeners can only remember one thing from our chat today, there was a wonderful study in Sweden. They took a bunch of healthy young guys and put them in the gym. They were all men in this study. Put them in the gym, took muscle biopsies, little chunks of muscle tissue from both their legs, and made them ride bikes for about 45 minutes, 3 or 4 times a week for 3 or 4 months. And then they did muscle biopsies again, took little chunks from both their legs. And the catch was they asked these guys to only pedal the bike with one foot, were one leg. They had the other foot on the floor. And the DNA methylation pattern was totally different in the leg that got exercised from the leg that just sat there, stood there on the floor. And in other words, the exercised leg was biologically younger than the non-exercised
leg. Oh, wow.
It's very cool because it's kind of like the perfect controlled experiment. Same body, same guy, same wife, same job, same food, same sleep, everything except exercising one leg and not the other. This was just a beautifully clear study.
Although I kind of feel bad for the guys trying to get back into shape.
Yes.
And get the other leg. You know. Let me remind our listeners again, you can join us. We want your questions about the impacts of exercise. Again, we all know it's good for us, but as Judy Foreman is telling us, there is a lot of new research that exercise can actually add years and health to your life. If you have questions about how that happens, or you want to tell your own story, we'd love to hear from you. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kathy from Conway wrote, she says, I'm 67 years old and make sure that I get 10,000 plus steps in a day. She says, I already have over 5,000 today. Wow, Kathy, it's only 9:15. And I'm drinking my veggie drink as we speak. She's 30 pounds lighter than a few years ago. Ski, hike, bike as much as possible. Kathy says, I'm in a half marathon in 3 weeks and never have been more energetic. Kathy says her doctor is pleased. Her blood pressure is low. She's on no meds at all. She says, I got to get this book. Kathy, good for you. Thank you for calling. You know, I'm impressed that she's 67 and she is running a half marathon. One of the things I have noticed as I get older, and I'm going to exercise, I enjoy it, but you know, your back hurts, your knees hurt. I mean, you know, sometimes you are prevented from doing this thing that helps you age by aging itself. You know where I'm coming from, Judy?
I do, sadly, personally as well. But this is not part of the book, but my own personal little thing is that as we get older, we have to do what I call injury juggling. Basically, keep exercising whatever doesn't hurt until the hurt part gets better. But I'm impressed, too, about the half marathon. In fact, one of the things I learned researching this book is that older runners are becoming the fastest growing segment of the running population. So it's actually not that unusual for people in their 60s and 70s to keep running or even start running. And as a side point to that, people should realize it's never too late to start exercise. So, you know, be inspired by some of these older people who are doing so well. Because it can happen to anybody who's, you know, basically, you know, not bound to a wheelchair can get some sort of exercise.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more then, because some people listening may say, oh, I'm 63 or 67 like Kathy. It's too late to start. I'm afraid I'll hurt myself. It's not worth it. I mean, do you get the benefits if you start at 65?
Absolutely. You really do. I mean, and you also lose the benefits if you stop. You know, it's absolutely true that you can start at any age. Obviously, you know, use common sense. If you've been sitting on the couch for 20 years or 30 years and you get up and try to run a marathon with no training, you're gonna probably end up sore, possibly sprain your ankle, maybe you have heart problems you didn't know about. You know, you can certainly check with your doctor, but you can start slow. You know, park in the far end of the parking lot and walk. Walk around the mall, try not to buy too much. I mean, just, you know, you can make little baby steps and soon you'll be going faster than you thought.
Well, coming up, I'm going to ask you a little bit more, Judy, about what you mean by exercise and the benefits of even what is often called moderate exercise. Some listeners may be wondering, wait, what does that mean exactly? Does walking my dog count, for example? Do I have to go to the gym and lift weights? We will talk about that after a short break, and we'll keep taking your comments and questions. Kathy, thank you for the email. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, exercise and aging. Everyone knows that being physically active is good for you, but now researchers are finding it can actually slow down the aging process. We're talking with science writer Judy Foreman about her new book, Exercise is Medicine. And we're hearing from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Judy worked for the Boston Globe for 22 years. In addition to the book we're talking about, she's the author of two others, A Nation in Pain and The Global Pain Crisis. One more time, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Judy, just before the break, we were talking about what is exercise? And a lot of people listening may think, oh, I hate going to the gym. It's smelly. It's crowded. So what is exercise?
Exercise is moving around. It's not staying still. Yes, there are certainly technical definitions for what's moderate and what's vigorous. But basically, the shorthand definition is, moderate exercise is what you can do and still talk to who's ever there, or nobody if you're by yourself, but you can't sing. In other words, you're a little bit out of breath, but you're not so out of breath that you can't have a conversation. A short, short sentences. And basically, the recommended minimum from the government is 150 minutes a week of this moderate intensity exercise. And that obviously can be broken down into 5 30-minute sessions. So 30 minutes a day for 5 days. That's pretty doable. And it doesn't have to be a consecutive 30 minutes. You can do several 10-minute sessions. And so it's really manageable. In fact, there's two things when people say, oh, I don't have time. There's two very powerful rebuttals to that idea. One, I realized in a story from a couple weeks ago, or 3 or 4 weeks ago now, in the New York Times, there was a study of 30,000-plus American adults, and they did what they call a time use study. They asked each person, how their 24 hours went, how it got chopped up. And obviously, there were obligatory things like work and washing the dishes and putting the kids to bed and paying taxes and all that stuff. But almost everybody still had 4 or 5 hours out of every 24 that was that they could make choices about, that they weren't already sort of pre-obligated to do things. Many people choose to do things other than exercise, but that time is there for most people. The other rebuttal to the I have no time argument is something that's becoming increasingly possible, and that's called HIIT, or H-I-I-T, which stands for High Intensity Interval Training. And basically, with this kind of exercise, you work really, really hard for a minute or 30 seconds and then do a recovery of a minute or two or three, back and forth a number of times. But you can compress a lot of your exercise into 10 or 20 minutes and get the same benefits. In fact, in some studies, this high-intensity workout gives you better cardio benefits than a longer continuous workout. So even if you only have 20 minutes, you can get a lot of the exercise benefits in terms of the cardiovascular stuff, at least, in a much shorter amount of time. And the data on this is very strong and very convincing.
So the excuse that you often hear, Judy, and given that you've written this book and given that you've been involved in this for a long time, is I don't have time. And you're basically saying I don't buy it.
Right. Exactly. And, even if you're watching the news, you can stand up and watch the news or kind of dance from one foot to the other, while you're watching. You don't have to sit on the couch to do that. But the high intensity thing is becoming very, very popular. And I highly recommend it. I resisted that. I read about that when I was doing the research for this book. And I thought, oh, God, that sounds absolutely awful. I don't like to work that hard. But I kind of got hooked on it.
Because then you can rest more, too.
Well, yeah, the original protocol was developed in Israel in the 70s, and it's called the Wingate Protocol. And you really, really work very, very hard for 30 seconds, and then you have a 3 or 4 minute recovery where you walk slower. This is on a treadmill or on a bike or an elliptical or running around the roads. And, you know, I don't like to do quite that hard. So I do, you know, a notch below that for a minute and then slower for a minute and back and forth, 1 minute, 1 minute. You can make up your own protocol. You can go on the web and find a bunch of protocols. You can read my book. It's pretty easy, and you can start, you know, really in a microscopic way. You can walk slowly from one telephone pole to the next and then, you know, run faster or walk really fast to the next set of telephone poles.
Kind of play games with yourself just to keep yourself going.
Yes, you can. Exactly, exactly. And or walking or running in hills. Hills kind of provides that extra challenge that going faster does. So it's still a workout for your heart. So these things are really, you know, if people hate exercise, it's a way to get it over with really fast.
Well, again, the name of the book is Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. The author is Judy Foreman. And Judy, tons of calls. Let's go to our listeners. Michael is joining us from Harrisville. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for this program. I'd like you to rethink your statement about people who are wheelchair-bound and exercise. My son has cerebral palsy, and he horseback rides, he swims, we go in swings, he walks.
Awesome.
With assistance. He does tons of stuff. And I've got other friends who have spinal cord injuries, and they ski, they mountain bike, they do everything.
Well, Michael, it's great to hear from you. I'm so glad you called. Go ahead, Judy.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I take your point enthusiastically. You know, you think of those guys playing wheelchair basketball. I guess I was thinking of people who really were essentially paralyzed. But you're completely right, and I apologize. Whatever you can still move, move. And it sounds like your son and his friends are doing great. And, you know, that's so inspiring. And just as a side note, I always find the Paralympics more inspiring even than the regular Olympics, because these are people who just don't let any sort of physical disability get in their way. So thank you very much for pointing that out.
Well, Dan writes us from Nashua. Thank you for a great discussion. Going to the gym for health sure sounds lovely, but with full-time work and 3 young kids, that's just not happening now. Dan asks, is regular structured exercise crucial, or can I realize many of the benefits by simply using my standing desk, eating well, and being generally active? I'm so glad you wrote, Dan, because you're right. It's hard when you're working and you have young children who are, you know, very needy, and you can't just say, okay, 3-year-old, you know, I'm going to the gym now. Take care of yourself. So thanks for the email, Dan. And go ahead, Judy.
Yeah, personally, I think chasing children counts way up there on the exercise
scale.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, one thing you're not doing is sitting. And so you're already doing great, you know, better than a lot of people. It's keeping on moving. And I bet if you wore one of those accelerometer devices like Fitbit or an Apple Watch or something, you would find that you were getting a lot of steps during the day, even though it wasn't on a treadmill or in the gym. So, yeah, it sounds a lot of people are in your situation. And I think, you know, while it's great if you can go to the gym or take 15 minutes and run around the block, it sounds like you're getting quite a lot of the benefits just by not sitting and kind of being on your feet all day long. That, you know, that goes a long way.
Dan, thank you for writing. And he says he has a standing desk. A lot of people at NHPR have standing desks, myself included, Judy. I mean, is that helpful, or is standing and sitting kind of the same thing if you're just standing there, you're not moving around?
Now, standing is better than sitting. When I wrote the book, the evidence was not in that much about standing desks. It may be now, and I haven't gone back to look. It certainly makes a lot of sense. But it's also, if you have a sitting desk, it's also fine to get up every hour. Either you can set your watch to make you get up, or you can, like I usually put my printer, you know, too far away to reach sitting down, or you make yourself get up and get a cup of coffee or go to the bathroom or, you know, start dinner or whatever. Just trying not to do all this consecutive sitting. If I could make one other point here, there was a very kind of depressing study, actually, in 2014 of 250,000 American adults. And even those people who exercise 7 hours a week, obviously that's like an hour a day, that's a goodly chunk of exercise. If they also sat for 7 hours, they still had an increased risk of heart disease and other things. So sitting is bad even if you're getting the exercise,
which I found personally totally depressing.
But you can counteract this by, you know, taking a 1 or 2 minute break every half an hour or hour and walking around. And for one of the Fitbits I used to have, it would beep me and tell me, you need 250 more steps this hour. So I'd get up and dance around the living room, get a drink of water, and come back. You know, it all helps. It all helps.
Let's take another call. This is Steve in Bedford. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Judy. I just wanted to share the fact that I just turned 79.
Congratulations,
Steve. I work in a large retail store part-time, three, four days a week. And, like, for example, I just added it up again. Last week, I got over 40,000 steps last week. And
wow.
Several miles. And I have had two hips replaced, both of them, and the right knee. But the left knee is hanging in there. And x-rays recently have shown that I now have a little more cartilage between the bones in my left knee.
Oh, because of all the standing and walking.
Half a dozen years ago. Yeah, right.
Wow.
And that's great.
And I just feel great. I'm very healthy. I don't have any diseases. I don't take any pills at all.
All right.
So, you know, the walking is just aces. It's just good.
Steve, thank you so much for calling in. Judy, go ahead.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, as our, like after World War II in particular, we kind of glorified the sedentary lifestyle and de-glorified jobs that involved physical labor. And what you're doing, Steve, is wonderful because you're on your feet all day and you're walking and you are getting those steps without even, you know, adding any extra time to your work day. I mean, that's the kind of job we all should have, ideally. And just for the record, 10,000 steps a day is kind of the goal that we all have in our mind. But it turns out that's kind of arbitrary. That came out of a study in Japan where the icon or whatever you call it, the little picture of 10,000 steps was a picture of a guy running. But it actually, you don't even need 10,000. 7,500 turns out to be enough for most of us. So you don't have to set goals that are impossible to reach. Even 7,500 steps are really good.
So a lot of people have called and said they walk and, you know, Steve walks around a lot at his job, stands a lot at his job and so forth. And clearly that's helping him. But you described moderate exercise earlier, Judy, to get these amazing benefits that you talk about as doing something where you can talk but not sing. So that doesn't sound like a stroll or, you know, walking up and down the aisles of a warehouse or
That's
something.
That's right. It's a
sounds
brisk walk.
Sounds a little
walk.
More intense. Yeah.
Yes, it's a brisk walk. Some people can, you know, if you have a bad knee or something, you know, it can be hard to do. But there are other ways to get it. Water aerobics is great for people with limb injuries. And, you know, there are, if you go to the gym, there are, they call arm bikes where you pedal a thing with, not pedal, but you use your arms to spin a
mm-hmm.
wheel. I mean, there are ways to get around a lot of different disabilities. But yes, I mean, walking, especially at a brisk pace, is really terrific.
Let's take another one. This is Aiden in Hill or Arden. Hi, good morning. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning, Laura. Thanks for the show. This is much needed for the masses.
We are the masses.
I'm not one of them. I've been training over 40 years, and I am approaching 70 years old. And last fall in September, I went in to have my annual, as they say, wellness check. So I asked the doctor, I said, so, you know my chronological age. Could you give me an idea of my physiological age? She looked at me and she said, early 40s.
Wow.
Yep. That's great.
What happened, I train 10 to 12 hours in the week every 10 to 12 hours a week every week in the gym, approximately 4 on Monday, same on Wednesday, and three on roughly Friday, and have been doing that for most of my life. There have been some hiatuses.
Sure.
And every time I took a hiatus, like in my late 40s, all my vitals went south.
Well, Arden, it's good to hear from you. And I'm thinking about, I mean, it's great what he's doing. I'm also thinking about Dan in Nashua, though, who wrote earlier, who, you know, has a job and three young kids. So, you know, not everybody needs to be like Arden to get these benefits that you're talking about.
No, but Arden does make an important point, which is when you stop exercising, you lose the benefits depressingly fast. You can lose 25% of your cardiovascular fitness if you stop exercising for just 3 or 4 weeks. And in fact, you start to lose them at, you know, if you don't exercise for 2 weeks. So the rule of thumb is rest is rust. You know, it doesn't pay off to rest if you can possibly keep going. Obviously, people get sick or they get injured and they have to take time off. And it does come back. You know, it's not like once you lose it, you're done for. It does come back. But it is a little discouraging that you lose it so fast.
Courtney in Newmarket writes, how important is the intensity of the exercise? Is low intensity not as effective as high intensity? Or is there an ideal ratio? Courtney, I'm sure that is a question a lot of people have. Thank you for writing. Go ahead, Judy.
Yeah, it surprised me a bit doing the research for this book. But yeah, intensity turns out to be a really important thing, which is one reason that the high intensity interval training, the HIIT training we were talking about a few minutes ago, is so important. It turns out that, you know, pushing yourself really hard for 30 seconds or a minute and then dropping back and then pushing hard again, you know, the back and forth seems to be particularly effective. So intensity does seem to be a really key variable. There are studies that show duration, you know, how long you exercise continuously also works, but increasingly the studies are showing that the intensity is really an important factor.
Now, how does that line up with what we talked about earlier, Judy, exercising moderately for half an hour for 5 days a week? That's that government recommendation. Increases lifespan by 3.5 years. So how do those two pieces line up?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, the government guidelines, that 150 minutes a week, that's the minimum. That's kind of the default position. That's, you know, no matter what's happening in your life, you got to do that. The high intensity stuff really gets you up beyond that, much greater levels of fitness. So, you know, both things are true. But bear in mind, the government recommendations are really the rock bottom minimum. And everything else is above that. So, yeah, they both count. And the minimum helps a lot in terms of warding off a number of diseases, particularly heart problems. But it's obviously basically more is better.
So how surprised were you, Judy, that such large benefits, I mean, again, a lifespan of more than 3 years accrued from such a small amount of activity? I mean, half an hour a day, 5 days a week, it's not that much.
Well, I wasn't really surprised. Once you think in terms of evolutionary biology, we are built to do this. This is what our genes are sort of asking us to do. So just, you know, half an hour a day, if you were a hunter-gatherer or a caveman or something, you wouldn't even be thinking about trying to do this. This would be built into your lifestyle. So the fact that it's beneficial seems like a no-brainer to me.
All right.
You know, we're built to do this.
Coming up, a lot more of your questions and comments, so keep them coming in. And also, Judy, I'm going to ask you, given these amazing benefits that you document in your book, has anybody ever tried to put exercise in a pill? This is really controversial, so we'll talk about that after a short break. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Go run around the room during this break, and then we'll be right back.
Membership contributions and local business support fuel the day-to-day work of NHPR. But there's another way to give that ensures a lasting future for public radio here in the Granite State. It happens when you make a gift through your will.
Hi, I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Plan Giving. By including NHPR as a beneficiary in your estate plan, you ensure future generations will have access to the integrity-based news and information that means so much to you. Learn more at nhpr.plangiving.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, Granite Staters involved in the Afghanistan war reflect on what it means to them. That's Thursday on The Exchange. This hour, we're talking with science writer Judy Foreman about her new book, Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. You can join our conversation with your questions about what kind of exercise, how much might be necessary, and also about some of the amazing science that Judy looks at in her book, about the conversations going on between our cells and how exercise enhances that conversation. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook, use Twitter. And right back to our listeners, Judy, Lynn is calling from the Lakes region. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. It's an exciting topic, and I couldn't wait to call and speak. I've been a practicing yoga instructor for many years and also have taken classes on my own before that. So it's like about 37 years of exercise through yoga. I just wanted to share with you that what it does is teaches you to go inside and find your value of yourself. So over the years, you continue to take better care of yourself, and it's a good way to balance out your exercise. I walk every day. I do not eat unless I do move.
Oh, wow.
I do not do it. I say to myself, you cannot. I'm like 112 pounds, 5'2", very tiny, but love to move. And Judy is absolutely right. You don't move, you rust. You definitely do.
Well,
and over time, it's just not good.
Well, Lynn, thank you. Yeah, for the call. I really appreciate it. And I love what she said about yoga. It's not just that the movement or the stretching of yoga may help you physically, but also the fact that you focus on yourself and then you want to do more for yourself. You want to do better for yourself. So that's really interesting. I had not thought about that. What do you think, Judy?
I think that's wonderful. Yeah, yoga can be, I love yoga. It can be very helpful. In terms of the cardio benefits, I suspect Lynn's walking is doing as much for her as yoga. The data on stretching compared to aerobic stuff kind of really does favor the aerobic, the more vigorous exercise. But yoga is certainly wonderful for a lot of things, including that, for lack of a better word, that meditative quality that Lynn was talking about. If we have time, there's one thing that we haven't touched on that I would like to talk on, which this is kind of a segue to that, which is what exercise does for the brain.
We should talk about that. Yes.
Because that is huge, and it's such a big thing that I actually have two separate chapters on exercise in the brain. One is on exercise and cognition, the thinking aspects of the brain, the intellectual decision-making aspects of the brain, and then mood, which also obviously stems from the brain. The evidence is overwhelming in favor of exercise for its effects on the brain. And a really key thing to remember, it's a jargony phrase, but when we exercise, our brain actually manufactures a chemical called BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which just means a chemical made in the brain that acts on nerve cells. And a scientist that I've talked to has dubbed this chemical Miracle-Gro for the brain, like that Miracle-Gro that makes plants blossom and look wonderful. This is essentially Miracle-Gro for the brain. When you exercise, your brain makes more of this chemical, this Miracle-Gro, and this chemical goes to the hippocampus, which is the main memory center in the brain, and literally causes new neurons to grow. The hippocampus gets bigger. And the data for the positive effects this has on cognition and memory is overwhelming. And there's just so much data. It was a medical writer's delight to write these chapters. There was a study from Ontario, Canada, that found that if everyone who was currently inactive became active, we could eliminate one in every seven cases of Alzheimer's.
Wow, that's amazing.
Exercise is actually the number one modifiable risk factor for preventing Alzheimer's. And even if you already have mild cognitive impairment or early stages of Alzheimer's, exercise can slow down the progression of the disease. It's incredibly beneficial. And while people may not think they want to exercise to make their heart better, everybody is worried about getting Alzheimer's and kind of losing it as you get older. And exercise is the best known way to help prevent that. The other thing that exercise does in terms of the brain is, again, through this same chemical, BDNF, the Miracle-Gro, the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and through a lot of the same mechanisms, increasing these levels of BDNF has a powerful effect on relieving and helping to prevent depression. It seems to work in conjunction with a chemical people have heard of, serotonin, and in a lot of the studies, exercise is as effective as medications for depression, and can really help prevent depression and help treat it if you've already got it. That's not to say that if you're worried about depression, you shouldn't talk to your doctor and you shouldn't take medication if that's an answer for you. But exercise has a powerful synergistic effect with the medications and sometimes can obviate the need for medication.
Well, given these enormous benefits that we've talked about this hour, Judy, and boy, we were talking earlier about the physical benefits, the longevity benefits, but now these brain benefits that you talk about are just incredible, warding off Alzheimer's and easing or maybe... I don't want to say curing, but easing the symptoms of depression or perhaps preventing anxiety and depression. Has anybody tried to put exercise in a pill?
Ah, yes, many people. In fact, I have a whole chapter on that. And at the outset, I should have to say I am not advocating pills as a substitute for exercise. And there's going to be an increasing deluge of ads for a lot of these pills. What struck me is that some of these pills actually do have a sound scientific rationale. The downside is that exercise, as we've hopefully seen in this conversation, has myriad effects all over the body. And if a pill just acts on one of these systems, who knows what it's doing to the others? It's far better to get these effects from exercise than from a pill. But yes, there are a lot of pills. And some of them are, as I said, are kind of in the mainstream, and a few of them are already FDA approved for people with other conditions, and they're being tested as a way to slow down aging or boost fitness. But a number of them are also banned substances, according to WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. So really, caveat emptor, buyer beware. I don't recommend these pills as a substitute for exercise.
Very interesting. Okay, Mike is calling in from Dover. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thank you for taking this call. This is a wonderful program. I wish we had it every week.
Go ahead, Mike.
I'm sorry, but the speaker stole my question. I wanted to bring up the idea that exercise also addresses psychological issues like depression, anxiety, ADHD, and so on, but I could extend the question is, what if you know someone who has one of those things, or if yourself, and I don't want to just say a friend of mine has it, if they have like depression, is there somewhere you can go and say, these are better specific exercises for depression, and these are better exercises for anxiety, and so on? Is there any book that has that kind of guidance, like prescription, as not with a drug, but with exercise?
Very interesting. Mike, thank you very much.
Well, there's my book. in general, most of the research has been done on aerobic exercise as opposed to strength training. So the data is quite strong in terms of aerobic exercise, meaning walking briskly or running or swimming fast or whatever. So in that sense, aerobic exercise has definitely been shown to be linked with depression. In fact, one of the studies I'm thinking of, people who are fit, according to like treadmill tests, have a 75% lower chance of getting depression than people who are unfit. So fitness really is a big protector against depression. I mean, obviously, it's not a total slam dunk. You may still need to see a doctor or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but it's a huge preventer. And it's free, basically, and you can do it. And it's it also has what I like to think of as a virtue effect. You can say to yourself, well, I did this for myself today, which is maybe not a direct biochemical thing, but you can give yourself some pats on the back. But the data showing the power of exercise to help prevent depression is incredibly strong. I mean, I've been a science writer my whole professional life, and most of the time as a medical writer, you get stories on the one hand this, on the other hand that. And with exercise and depression, the data totally line up in favor of exercise as a powerful mitigator.
Although if someone's depressed, it may be hard to get them off the couch.
Well,
and to
that's
do something.
True.
You know, it's hard to sort of start.
That is true. And even if you're not depressed, it can be hard to start.
Sure.
The motivational piece for exercise is that's a complicated thing because rationality and facts don't always persuade people to change their habits. I mean, look at smoking, how hard it is for people to stop that, even though they know it's bad for them. Several things can help, though, and including, like, if you have a friend that you can make a deal with that will meet every morning at 9 for a walk, you're more likely to do it because you sort of have this obligation to the other person. Group exercises can be fun. Committing to a schedule where you know, you just do it, you make it non-negotiable, because if exercise is negotiable, almost anything else can win out over exercise.
Well, and I've
you
heard
have to really
yeah,
make it.
That's why people who exercise in the morning are more likely to stick with it, because other stuff doesn't get in the way.
Yeah, that's a big advantage of getting it out of the way.
Yeah.
I don't like to do it so early in the morning. I'm sort of a noontime exerciser. But whatever, you know, there's actually no really best time of the day that the experts say whenever works for you. And that's, you know, that's sort of similar to the answer I've asked a lot of exercise physiologists. So what's the best kind of exercise? And the answer is the one you can do, the one you don't hate, the one you can actually get yourself to do. So, you know, it's very individualized what becomes your thing.
Well, a bunch of emails have come in. David writes, this conversation focuses on the value of cardiovascular exercise. Would your guest please speak to the value of strength training, especially the science? David, it's a great question. And I've read the studies, Judy, that show, you know, muscle mass deteriorates after age 40 or 30. So strength training is important, too. But, you know, you're not sweating it out so much when you strength train. At least I'm not,
yeah.
But maybe that's my problem.
No, it's not your problem. It's a great question. I mean, historically, most of the research has been done on the aerobic stuff, but strength training is essential, especially as you get older, because there is muscle wasting called sarcopenia, and that is huge. And one of the reasons that people wind up in nursing homes is if they don't have the muscle strength in their quadriceps to get out of the chair or to get off the toilet or to, you know, get out of bed and into a chair. So yes, muscle wasting is a huge problem, and strength training is the answer to that. And I thank the caller very much, because that is very important. And there's a growing amount of data showing the value of that. And even you can get some cardiac benefits from strength training. So, yeah, that is definitely a key. It's actually, I should have mentioned it. It's part of the government recommendations, several times a week doing basic strength training exercise. So, yes, absolutely, it's important.
That doesn't have to be going to the gym and lifting weights. It could be just doing push-ups and squats and stuff at home. I mean, people don't need to join an expensive gym.
True, although I find just doing push-ups quite challenging.
But
I mean,
you know what I'm
that's
saying?
Moving
like, not
everybody.
Whole,
I do.
Especially in New
yes.
Hampshire, you know, we have a lot of rural areas. People don't have access to a gym, or yesterday the roads were really icy. So it can be challenging for folks.
Absolutely. But you can do a lot at home. I mean, you can get gallon jugs of milk and raise them over your head or to the sides. You can find other things that you can use as weights, including, as the yoga person was saying, you can use your own body weight as a weight.
Sure. Get some bricks from the backyard.
Yes.
Kelly
exactly.
writes in, I really want to read this to you, Judy, before we close out, because she makes a really important point. Kelly says, I want to know what these people who are exercising multiple hours a day are doing for work. I'm a paramedic who works 24 hours at a time. Most of my day is spent sitting, whether it's sitting in a vehicle waiting for a call, or sitting driving the ambulance, or sitting in the back taking care of someone. Kelly says most of the time our employers won't even let us put exercise equipment in a base. They claim that if we should get hurt exercising at work, it would become a workman's comp issue. Not to mention that even if we did have the ability to exercise, we would have to be careful not to sweat, as we may get called out at any moment to take care of someone, and we don't want to arrive all sweaty and smelly. Now, in terms of sweaty and smelly, it sounds like you said earlier, a moderately brisk walk counts. But I yes. hear what she's saying. Some people have very demanding jobs. And as soon as they go yeah. from those very demanding jobs, they go home to, you know, families. So it is tough for people like
it
Kelly and others
tough.
To find time. And then they hear other people call and say, hey, I exercise 2 hours a day. And, you know, it makes them crazy. So,
yes, I totally sympathize. I'm in awe of that, the work you do.
Yeah,
Kelly,
thank you, Kelly, for that.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess do the best you can. And on your off days, I assume you do get some off time, you know, get some sleep and then exercise and do the best you can. I mean, the exercise guidelines from the government do say, this may be a little encouraging, do call for 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise, or 75 minutes, half that, more vigorous. So you could pack that into a weekend if you have such a thing as a weekend, or, you know, pack more intense stuff into the time when you do have off. But I totally sympathize. That work schedule is almost inhumane. Maybe you should get your employers a copy of my book. And a lot of workplaces do put in gyms, and I don't know how they deal with the insurance issues, but people do get around this somehow.
Well, and the book is called Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. Judy, what's the most important thing that you learned working on this book? You've been a science writer for a long time, but it sounds like you learned a lot.
I did. And what I take home basically is just do it. Do the best you can and just keep doing it. It's absolutely worth it. If you have 10 minutes a day, walk around instead of sitting. I mean, if you're talking to somebody on the phone, put the phone in your hand and walk while you talk. Stand on one foot while you're brushing your teeth. Anything is better than nothing.
All right. Really great to talk to you, Judy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's longtime science writer Judy Foreman. Again, her book is Exercise is Medicine. Judy's the author of two other books called A Nation in Pain and The Global Pain Crisis. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.